Since March 2007, one online audio production group has pushed the boundaries.
Broken Sea Audio Productions presents Maudlin.
It's sounding board. Audio drama with Lumpy Bits.
You have been listening to Jake Sanson.
Broken Sea Audio Productions presents
My name is Feedback, and these are my stories.
Last time on Gaia's Voyages.
This is the Broken Sea Audio production of Escape from New York.
OTR Swag Cast.
Doctor Who, starring Mark Telita as the Doctor.
BrokenSea.com. New audio every Thursday.
Captain Bone Marrow here. The smell of the sea. I love it. But sometimes when a pirate's been out a-plundering for something close to a year without a bath, then a pirate needs a strong, manly scent to cover up his own strong, manly scent and to entice the barmaids. That's why I use the Frequency of Fear. It has the refreshing scent of old-time radio, both sci-fi and horror, as well as Halloween novelty records, and sci-fi and monster rock music. And if that weren't enough, there's the smell of adventure, as the zombie astronaut, and Dr. Despicable, and Dr. Wilhelm von Martinez, and the rest of them, drag me pirate booty into some truly asinine situations. Since I've been using the Frequency of Fear, the lasses can't keep their hands off me.
Oh! You tick-infested brute!
That's a saucy one. So if you are a fan of horror and sci-fi old-time radio and Halloween novelty albums and the occasional sci-fi or monster rock song, not to mention truly, truly asinine situations, then tune into the Frequency of Fear. It's a smell you'll never get off ya.
Find the link to the Frequency of Fear at www.zombieastronaut.net.
And now, it's time for the Broken Sea Audio Production OTR Swag Cast.
Welcome back to the Swag Cast. It's a sci-fi Thursday, woo. I'm just in the mood for some sci-fi, so we have our normal ongoing serials from the Avengers and Flash Gordon. As for our one-off anthologies, we have two from X-1, Shock Troop and Volpa, as well as The Martian Chronicles from Dimension X. Enjoy!
Countdown for blast-off. X-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X-minus 1, fire.
From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
Tonight, Shock Troop. And now, X minus one, and tonight's story, Shock Troop.
In all his seven major campaigns, Commander Zerum Lassen had never faced anything like this. First, there was the heat, agonizing, insufferable heat. Then there were the jolts, the convulsions. But most unbearable of all was the cross pulse, the interminable, monotonous thrump-thrump of the cross pulse.
Come in. Hello, Perak. Close the bulkhead. This heat's driving me mad.
Zerium, I think we ought to abandon this project.
Abandon?
As chief psychotechnician, I recommend it.
Oh? On what do you base this?
This macroorganism is unlike anything we've ever tried to colonize before. It's much too complicated.
Complicated? Perak, I've colonized life forms on seven other worlds, and each time I've been advised to turn back.
I know your record, Zerim, but this creature is different.
How?
Well, for one thing, it has a highly organized psychoelectric system. The shock waves are fantastic. I've already lost three technicians.
These are shock troops. They know the risk.
And for another
Perak,
thing...
Perak, you're a fine scientist, but you're no leader of troops. This creature we've invaded will be subdued and brought under positive permanent control. We will achieve thermobiological conditioning to reduce the heat. We will achieve damping to muffle the crossbeat. And we will establish neuromuscular controls. And we will do all these things because I say we will. Now come along. We'll inspect the tunnels. Ready?
Yes. I'll open the bulkhead.
Feel that heat.
Well, the thermo crews are doing everything they can to pull oxygen from the separators.
I'll tell them to work faster. What's the status of the control panel?
I'll see. Amandor.
Sir?
What's the status of the control panel?
We've tapped into motor fibers 1 through 46, Chief. We'll be ready for the central selector hookup very soon.
What about optical auditory intercept?
We're still trying to tap into the subject's visual system, Commander. The screens are set up, but we haven't been able to run a line from the main circuit.
Why not?
Charge in the main trunks is too potent, sir. Our instruments won't take the surges of current.
Any installed transformers or resistances? Now get it down.
But, sir, two crews working in this heat with that noise...
I don't care about the heat or the noise. It is absolutely essential that we hook up visual intercept. I want you to...
Convulsions!
Hit the stanchions! Hang on!
It's passed.
I've never seen them quite this bad. What do you suppose causes them?
I don't know. I suspect their reflex actions.
Sir?
What?
Do you suppose this creature knows we're inside it?
Ceaselessly, the shock troops worked inside the host creature, burrowing through capillaries, tapping into nerves, trying desperately to intercept the intelligence and sensations so they might bring it under control. Oxygen was pulled from the separators to cool the tunnels where Commander Lassen's troops were.
Yes?
Sir, we phased the interior to feedback. We're ready to try for an image on the visual screens.
Excellent.
What about vocal auditory?
Completely phased. We haven't broken the speech code yet, but all sounds are clearly audible.
Blast that crossbeat. Can't the crews do something to muffle it?
We're trying. We don't dare go into the main arteries, not yet at least.
Have they calcified?
They're trying, Zerim. We've got calcification crews working like demons trying to harden the central blood vessels.
Very well. Lieutenant, is the screen ready?
Yes, sir. Does the commander wish to monitor himself?
Yes. These are standard controls, I assume?
Yes, sir. Focus is this knob. Brightness control is at the right.
Very good. Now, switch on and we'll see if we can see what this creature sees. A little more focus.
Something's coming through.
It isn't a clear enough image. Bring up the contrast. There.
Well?
It appears that our host is in an enclosed space of some sort. From the orderly flow of articles across the screen, I would say it was moving. Aimlessly. As an item for resting on, it appears. In the background, a blurred pattern of light and dark stripes. Now, let's hear the auditory reception. May as well get the decoding section working on it.
I'll switch it on, sir. The creature doesn't seem to be vocalizing.
No What's the noise?
I believe that's a respiratory sound, sir, made by the creature's oxygen plant.
Well, try to eliminate it. Filter it out.
Yes, sir.
Doc, I tell you, I'm sick.
It's vocalizing.
I'm not trying to pull anything, Doc. There's something living inside me. Honest. Doc, please.
Try to break down the pattern. I want to know what the creature is communicating.
Yes, sir.
Well, Parrock, do you still think we should turn back?
We've tapped into the creature's communication system, Zareem. I think controlling it is going to be another matter.
Inside the subject, the work continued hour after hour, day after day. Inside the control room, Commander Lassen was haggard and weary. Outside, the crews labored in the tunnels, calcifying blood vessels, tapping into sensory nerves, tying circuits across sympathetic nerve fibers, and still no positive control.
Zareem?
Oh, Eric. What's happening?
Well, we're making slow progress, Zareem. Between the heat and the cross-pulse, the men are beginning to crack up. They need a rest.
Anyone caught loafing on the job will be fed into the disposal units. Those are my orders.
Isn't that a bit harsh?
Are you questioning my authority?
Yes, I think you've been working too hard.
I'll have you... Listen.
What?
The silence. They've done it. Modification section has muffled the crossbeat.
You're right.
What a relief. Come on, let's try the audio-visual again. Maybe we'll be able to hear something now.
There's a picture coming in.
Same picture. Blurry, barred pattern. Objects for sitting and reclining. Switch on the auditory.
Right. It's vocalizing.
Listen.
I guess I didn't. It happened all of a sudden. This pain in my heart. Like it slowed down. I'm sick. There's something wrong with me.
If only decoding would crack the speech pattern so we knew what it was saying.
There seems to be another macroorganism in the room with it. Dressed in white, it seems.
Yes, I see.
I'm not faking, Doctor. We better do something.
I want the speech pattern given number one priority. No time for... That's condition red!
Commander, a vein is ruptured in Tunnel C. There's a leukocyte breakthrough.
Get the guns. I want a coagulant crew in there at once.
There are hundreds of the monsters, Commander. Shall we seal off the tunnel?
And lose weeks of calcifying? Come on, we'll try to coagulate.
The commander joined the rush of frenzied emergency troops rushing into the corridor. Ahead, crews were lugging hand sterilizers and broad-spectrum coagulators. Inside the tunnel, the scene was bedlam. There was a break in the wall, hemorrhaging profusely. Crewmen waded knee-deep in the nauseous sea of thrombin. Red corpuscles knocked them off balance. Every so often, a sickening gray leukocyte would rear up and embrace a crewman in a grip of acid death.
We'll have to retreat. The thrombin's rising. Lieutenant, give the order to fall back and seal off the tunnel.
Yes, sir.
Fall back. Seal the tube. Fall back.
The struggle continued. New tunnels were formed. More nerves tied into central control. Veins and arteries calcified. The heat reduced to a livable temperature. Slowly, the morale of the shock troops inched higher. And Commander Lassen relaxed and grew more amiable.
Well, Parrock, ready for the big event?
Yes, my crew is standing by.
Good. We'll try an auditory visual intercept first, and then we'll attempt to control a few responses.
We've tapped into the creature's hearing circuit now so that we can hear what it hears as well as what it says.
Excellent. Switch on the screen. It's coming in now. The creature is still in the same room, Alone, evidently. Yeah, it seems to be writing a message of some sort.
Oh, wait.
It's talking.
My appeal was turned down. And this is it.
Now, let's try a motor response. Lieutenant Mander.
Sir?
Which circuit controls the organism's right extremity?
This one, sir.
Are all circuits properly insulated against electrical surge?
Up to 1 million dynarcs, Commander.
Now, we've never encountered anything higher. That should be safe enough. And here goes. I'll try a simple contraction.
It worked! The right limb contracted. Peric, it worked. We've established control.
You're to be congratulated, Commander.
Thank you. Switch on auditory visual again. Ah, the creature is still writing.
Actually, I don't mind too much. The doctors have discovered that I have a serious condition of the blood vessels and heart. They call it sclerosis. And I've been feeling awful lately. So, I'm not too afraid of what's coming. I'll think of you. Think of me. Love, Sam.
Now, the message is concluded. Let's try another motor response. I'm going to manipulate the creature's legs now to make it locomote toward the barred pattern. Ready?
Ready, sir.
It's moving! Excellent, excellent!
Peric, have the crews clean up the remaining circuits. Make absolutely certain that the electrical hazard is reduced to a minimum. I can't afford to lose any more troops. Now, what about the speech code?
Decoding thinks they may break it any moment now.
I'll keep them working. Give the troops extra rations and pay and commend them for a good job. If all goes well, we'll send for colonists within a week.
Exactly 1 week later, Commander Lassen, seated in a compartment that was now fully air-conditioned, silent, and filled with soft Valvarisian music, radioed to the Commissioner of Colonization.
So everything is ready. With the exception of the speech code, we have complete primary control of all circuits. We'll expect first 10,000 colonists as soon as transport can be arranged. Lassen, I'll send that at once. Come in. What is it, Peric?
I don't know. There are changes in the intercept screens.
What kind of changes?
Well, for one thing, there's a temperature drop in the upper quadrant of the creature. Then it seems to be changing its surroundings.
I'll come out and have a look.
There, you see? There are other macro creatures in the room now. There. One of them has a black robe.
Well, what's so alarming?
The speech pattern of the black-robed creature is unlike anything we've ever heard before.
Turn on auditory intercept. Strange.
Look at the temperature drop up there.
Let me try touching the creature's cranial region. That explains the temperature drop. The mat of thread-like growth has been entirely removed.
Look, the black-robed one has moved away. Now another creature approaches.
Our host entity is being seated. Now, bands are being placed on its wrists and legs. That's interesting.
I don't like it.
What are you worried about?
I don't know. It frightens me.
Look. Now a dome-like object is being lowered over the creature's head, a great cupola.
It's cutting out the light.
Turn off the auditory.
I don't want to die, Warner. Not in the electric chair.
I wish we knew the speech code. Well, another few days and we'll have it broken. Then, total victory will be ours. Total victory.
What's happening now, Zarim?
I don't know. Everything is quiet. The creature is waiting in the dark for something to happen, apparently. I wonder what.
Fred Collins again. Tonight, X-1 has brought you Shock Troop, a story from the pages of Galaxy, written by Daniel Gallion and adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Featured in our cast were Bernard Lenro as Commander Lassen, Edwin Cooper as Perrock, John Thomas as Mandor, Ralph Camargo as Sam, and Roger DeCoven was the narrator. This is Fred Collins speaking. X-1 was directed by George Voutsas and is an NBC Radio Network production.
Presenting the amazing interplanetary adventures of Flash Gordon. Last week, Flash Gordon narrowly escaped death when Saul, the jealous general, fired at his back and caused him to be thrown from his horse. Queen Azora would have killed Saul with her sword, but Flash nobly spared his life. That night, Mara the spy learned of the Blue Magic Army's plan to attack the Hawkmen at daybreak and escape from the palace to warn Zarkoff and tell him the reason for Flash's strange behavior. Next morning, Azura gave Flash a torpedo to hurl when he got close enough to the Hawkmen. As the attack began, Mara the spy reached the entrance to the tunnel, but just as he was about to reveal the secret of Flash's failure to recognize his friend, Mara was killed by a ray from the guns of the Blue Magic Men. At that moment, Flash Gordon was sighted riding straight for the tunnel, and Dr. Zarkoff, thinking he was deserting the Blue Magic Army, went out to welcome him to the ranks of the Hawkmen. When Flash reached the entrance to the tunnel, he pulled his horse to a stop and hurled the torpedo, which immediately exploded. And now we continue the story. Shouts and tumult, the army of Blue Magic Men with Queen Azura at their head reached the tunnel entrance.
Oh! Azura, it worked. It worked. The enemy are frozen into icicles.
Of course it worked, my prince. Didn't I tell you what would happen when you threw the torpedo?
You're wonderful, Azura. Why are men such fools as to try to fight against you?
They don't for long.
Azura, do you know this man, frozen with his hand upraised?
Do you?
No. But...
But what?
Well, it seems as though I should know him.
Here, drink this vodka. It will refresh you after your hard ride. Why do you think you should know this man, my prince?
When I rode up to throw the torpedo, this man came out of the tunnel with his hand upraised. Just as it is now.
He may have been about to surrender.
No, he didn't say anything about surrendering.
He spoke to you? What did he say?
He called, Flash Gordon. Flash, my friend. He surprised me so, I almost forgot to throw the torpedo.
Thank the gods you didn't forget.
Why should this man call me friend? I've never seen him before.
It was a trick, Flash. When he saw you carrying the torpedo, he tried to deceive you, to throw you off your guard.
Well, it almost worked.
You are a man of steel, my prince. What self-control you have. Ah, you are truly the man of my heart.
Am I, my beautiful one? It makes me very happy to hear you say that.
My prince. Paul?
Your Majesty.
Have the prisoners carried back to my palace. Be very careful of this one.
Oh, yes, Your Majesty. Your command shall be obeyed to the letter, Your Majesty. Captain, see that this prisoner is taken back to the palace in good condition.
Why are you so particular about the man who calls me?
Flash, did you ever hear of a man called Zarkoff?
Zarkoff? Zarkoff? No, Azura, I've never heard of him. Who is he?
That is the man who calls to you. In his own country, he is a wizard. That wall of chemical ice, which protected him and his men from our combustion rays, is an example of his magic skill.
I don't wonder you handle him with care. He should be a most valuable man to have around.
You see my point exactly. I shall have Tal revive him when they get back to the palace. And by the way, Flash.
Yes, Azora?
The fumes of the torpedo sometimes cause strange reactions. So if you meet this Zarkov and he insists on calling you friend, remember that was the last thing on his mind before the torpedo exploded.
I quite understand, Azora.
Good. And now, my victorious prince, shall we celebrate?
Back in the palace, Tall carried out the Witch Queen's order. He strapped the frozen Zarkov to a table, then he tipped it into the rays of an electrotherapeutic revivifier.
Take care of this one, she said. I wonder why. As a taste changed from youth to middle age. If so, I must see what I can do to win her favor. Ah, you are thawing out, are you? Good. I'll give you a little more heat. How's that, stranger?
Oh, be careful. The current's on full strength. You know what that may do?
Oh, yes, I didn't notice the indicator. Be very careful of this one, she said. Yes, Your Majesty. We'll take care of him. You are coming around, are you? All right, stranger. Loose the strap, slave. Come on now. Well, stranger, come on, get on your feet.
Flash Gordon. Flash, my friend.
Flash Gordon is not here.
Who are you? What has happened? Where am I?
You are a prisoner of Azura, Queen of Magic, and your friend Flash Gordon captured you.
Now I know you. You!
Stand back. I have my sword point against your breast. One move and I'll run you through.
I came to rescue Flash Gordon.
Rescue him. He doesn't need to be rescued.
You mean, tell me the truth, you wizard of darkness. Has Flash turned traitor?
He has drunk the Queen's magic drug and has forgotten you and his sweetheart, Dale Arden, and even his own identity.
Thank the gods. I was afraid the change was due to Flash himself. What is this drug of forgetfulness?
Lithium. God!
General
Saul? Take this new slave to the kitchen and tell Her Majesty makes up her mind how she will dispose of him.
Thank you, General Dow.
Now, don't thank me. I had my way. You wouldn't be here now.
March this way, slave.
Wait. General Dow, what has happened to Dale Arden?
You will see her in the kitchen.
She is alive, then?
Yeah.
And gone.
Gone? Oh, yes, that must be the other one. Yes, he's there, too. Take him away, God.
Come along, slave.
Here, you. Put this machine and apparatus away. Clean up this room.
These are the kitchens, I presume.
Yes, but see that you don't presume too much around here.
Oh, a joke. Not bad.
Stop laughing. It will be no joke if you start any trouble, and we have to electrocute you.
Quite so, quite so. Why is that animal carcass placed between those machines?
Those machines are two electrodes. The flaming rays are roasting the carcass.
Very interesting, very interesting. Electrodes, eh? A much quicker process than roasting in an oven.
Dr. Zarkov! Dr. Zarkov!
Dale! Dale Arden!
Stay here, slave, while I get a set of manacles for you. Oh, Lieutenant, what's this?
Oh, you're safe. Ma reached you in time, and he got there safely.
Yes, Ma reached me safely, Dale. But just as we were pulling him into the tunnel...
He was killed?
Yes.
Oh.
He was hit by a ray from the Queen's soldier.
Poor Ma. Then he didn't tell you about Flash.
No, he was killed just as he was about to.
Oh, Dr. Zarkov. I've been so lonely.
Oh, yes.
Flash has turned against me. He's completely forgotten me.
No.
Yes. He's in love with that wicked Queen of Magic.
No, Dale. Flash has been drugged. He has lost his memory.
Drugged?
Yes.
That's just what Khan and I thought might have happened. How did you find out?
A general named Tao told me.
Tao? That's the Queen's right-hand man. Her chief magician. She ought to know.
Oh.
Dr. Zarkov, we must save Flash.
Yes, Dale, we must save Flash. And ourselves, too.
Oh, I'm so glad you've come. Con and I both wish you were here to help us. You know so much about science and electricity.
Where is Con? Tal said I would see him here.
Well, in getting away from the palace, Ma went out the servant's gate. Con and I went with him to see that the coast was clear.
Yes, and go on.
We saw him slip out safely. The next thing we knew, the guard came after us to our quarters and blamed us for his escape.
How could they have linked you with Ma?
Oh, they had seen us talking together.
Oh.
And one of the inner guards had challenged us near the gate just before Ma slipped out.
I see. But what has happened to Con?
To separate us. Con is in a cell somewhere. They bring him in here to do his work and take him away again.
I shall be glad to see him. Here's that fellow, Tao.
Well, what is going on here? Get to work, slave.
What is the hurry, Tao? We have got lots of time for work.
Come, come, no back talk. You'll taste the electric whip. Oh, God. See that this new prisoner learns our magic discipline.
Yes, General Tao.
Yes, and you.
Yes, General Tao.
Prepare some little cakes and fill these two flagons with Vako. Her Majesty and Flash wish refreshment.
At once, General Tao.
Her Majesty is very particular about these solid gold flagons. See that Flash Gordon gets this large, two-handled one, and Her Majesty the smaller and more delicately shaped one.
Yes, General Tao.
Well, well, what are you standing there for? Hurry, hurry. Can't you see the dragon's eyes over there flashing?
What has that got to do with Dale's stuff?
Whenever Queen Azura reaches some bottle, those dragon's eyes light up. You can almost judge her mood from the flash of the eyes.
Wonderful.
Yes, I shall tell Her Majesty you are coming. Hurry now, hurry.
I'm sorry I can't stay to talk with you, Dr. Zarkov. We have so much to say to each other.
That is true, Dale. But we shall have plenty of time around here to talk later. You attend to your duties. In the meantime, until they get those manacles for me, I'll have a look around the kitchen.
Very well. I'll take these into Flash and Queen Azura.
Well, it's about time. What kept you, girl? You think you had to make the vato instead of just pour it? I'm sorry to be so long, Your Majesty.
Come, Azura. This is a night of celebration and gladness. Let's not spoil it.
As you say, my prince. Here, drink this vato. Have one of these little cakes. I'm sure you'll like them.
Thanks. I'll have one of the cakes.
Nothing to drink with them?
Well, I'll take a sip of the vodka to keep you company.
My throat is parched. Give me that flagon, girl.
You had a hard day of it, Azura.
Ah, that tastes good. You're sure you don't care for any more, my prince?
No, no more for me, thanks.
Take the flagon and cakes away, girl.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Dale.
Yes, Dr. Zarkov.
I have it. I have the plan to save us all.
You have? Oh, what is it, Dr. Zarkov?
Get your tray down.
There. Now, Dr. Zarkov, what is your plan?
While you were gone, the guard slashed me with his electric whip. I had just thought of the way to repay him. Now I want you to knock over those dishes piled up there on that table.
Then the guard will beat me.
Oh, no, he won't.
He has beaten others for less cause. Why won't he beat me?
Because when you knock the dishes over, I will jump up on that platform and grab one of those electrodes that is being used to roast the meat and swing its flaming ray on the chief cook and the guard as they stop for you.
Oh, Dr. Zarkov, if the attempt should fail...
Do not think about that, Dale. It must not fail. Do as I tell you. Everyone's back is turned just now. Hurry.
Very well. Here goes.
Dr. Zarkov,
save me.
Stand back from that girl, or I will bring you both to a crisp.
Are the tables to be turned? Can Dr. Zarkov single-handed overcome Queen Azura's guards and rescue Dale Arden? Meanwhile, goodbye until next week when we'll be back with another chapter in the amazing interplanetary adventures of Flash Gordon.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Tonight, Volpla by Wyman Gwyn. But first, hear this.
Hello, I'm Dorothy Olson, singing schoolteacher on NBC's big weekday musical show, Bandstand. But right now, I'd like to talk to you parents. I'd like to ask you a few questions as you're getting ready to send your youngsters back to school. Are you helping your child get the most out of his school? Do you make his home conditions favorable enough for him to do his homework? Do you show an interest in his schoolwork? Remember, your child's success in school and later on in life depends to a large degree on your attitude towards his schooling today. And there's another important thing. Everyone needs a good send-off in the morning, and that goes for children, too. Be sure your children have a substantial breakfast and a cheery goodbye before they head for school each day. Remember, you can't expect your child to do it all himself. Encourage him in his schooling, both in your attitude and in your actions as he goes back to school this fall.
Now, X minus one and Volpla.
Lunch, dear.
Oh, I'll be right there.
Old hermit, I have a buffet on the terrace.
I'm coming. So, I'm an old hermit, am I? And our daughter says I'm eccentric now. I wonder how the devil she ever found out.
From me, of course.
But you love me just the same.
Oh, Max, what's got into you? Stop it.
Oh, I reached the dangerous age. And, lady, I'm going to have fun.
Well, come on out to the terrace. The hamburgers will get cold.
My dear, I'm going to have a new kind of fun.
Oh?
It's a joke. I'm going to play a tremendous joke on the whole world. I had been working for this moment for 10 years, and now, Volplas, three of them, a male and two females. I had called them Volplas since that day 10 years ago when I got the idea of creating a flying mutant, which I would teach to feed, play, and talk. Now I was almost ready to play my joke on the world. After lunch, when I returned to the lab, the Volplas were moving about on the mattress where I had placed them, and the male was trying to stand. They were about 28 inches high. Except for the face, chest, and belly, the Volplas were covered with a soft, almost golden down. The skin was pink. Upon his head and across his shoulders, the male had a shock of fur as soft as a chinchilla. The cranium was in the same proportion to the body as it is in the human. And they were shockingly human-eyed. When the male spread his arms, the span was 48 inches. I held his arms out and tried to tease the spars open. These spars turned backward and ran alongside the wrist almost to the elbow. Powerful wrist muscles could snap them outward and forward. Suddenly, as I teased the male Volpla, this happened. The spar shot outward, adding 9 inches to each side of his span. The lateral skin, that had until now been resting in folds, was tightened into a golden plane that stretched from the tip of the spar to his waist. A true gliding plane, perhaps even a soaring plane. By 4 o'clock that afternoon, they were ready for their first solid food. Come on now, here, hold the cup. That's the way. Hold the cup. Oh, you're a beauty. You're all beauties. No, no, no. Come on. Hey, don't climb on my back. No, no, no. Now stop. Oh, that's better. Oh, hello, pretty one. Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
So that's the way it's going to be, eh? Hello, hello.
Hello, 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 hello.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Oh, you have no idea what I have in store for you, my dears. I will teach you a language. Perhaps English, or simple basic English.
You will have your own crafts, and you'll live in small tree houses, and I'll teach you legends that you came from the stars, that you watched the red men and the white men, and you listened to their speech. And when you're able to take care of yourselves, I'll turn you loose. There'll be Volpla colonies up and down the coast before anyone suspects. And then, my dear, one day, somebody will see a Volpla, and the scientists will observe them. Then the legends will come. Isn't that funny? Don't you think that's terribly funny?
Funny!
You're listening to Volpla. Now, back to X-1 and Act 2 of Volpla.
I used the metabolic accelerator to cut the Volpla's gestation down to 1 week, and I used it to bring the infants to maturity in 1 month. By the next spring, I had a colony of over 100 Volplas, and I shut down the accelerator. From now on, they could have their babies in their own way. I had devised a language for them, and I carefully adulterated it with English, as if they had observed us and learned. My Volplas were amazing. They were bilingual. Jane and Susie went down to Santa Barbara for a week, and I took the opportunity to ship the male and the oldest two females out of the lab. I put them in a jeep beside me and drove to a secluded valley about a mile back in the ranch.
Tree, 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 rock, sky, sky, sky.
That's right, Chief. That's the sky. All right, come on now. Everybody out. Run, jump.
Jump, jump. Run, run, run. Sky, sky,
that's
sky.
That's right. That's
sky.
Right. Take off. Go ahead. He spent about 2 hours chasing the two girl Volplas around, and then he made a leap for one. And when he spread his arms, his spars snapped out, and those golden planes sheared into the air.
Yay! Yay! Yay!
He sailed over her, and he rose up, and he hung in the breeze for a long moment, 3 feet above the ground.
Fly! Fly! Fly!
That's right! You can fly! You can fly!
Oh, fly! Fly! Fly!
They learned quickly and brilliantly. They were not really flyers. They were gliders and soarers. Before long, they took agilely to the trees and launched themselves in beautiful glides for hundreds of feet, banking and turning and spiraling to a gentle halt. Oh, I laughed out loud with anticipation. Wait until the first pair of these is brought before a sheriff. Wait till the newspaper reporters are routed out into the hills to witness this. When they were tired, the Volplas lay on their backs with their planes stretched out. The oldest one came over to me. He squatted, his elbows resting in the ground, his wrists crossed at his chest.
Before the red men, we live here.
That's right. In places like these, you lived all along these mountains. Now there are very few of you left. Since you've been staying in my place, you've naturally forgotten the ways of living outdoors.
We learn again. We stay here.
That's right. Now look. Look, you see up in that tree? That's a bird. That's your food, if you can kill it.
How?
Well, I don't think you can get at them in the tree. You'll have to soar up above and catch one of them on the wing when they fly away. Go ahead, try. He climbed the tree and launched himself and caught a warm updraft from the hillside. In no time, he was about 200 feet away. He began working his way, crisscrossing back to us, and then suddenly he dived. He caught the bird! He caught the bird!
Bird! Bird! Bird! We eat!
Yes, yes, you eat this. I'll show you how to build a fire. Again, I told them the story I had made up. How they came long before the red men in a ship from the stars. I taught them to point to the planet Venus and say that was the star they came from. I grinned to think of the many stories that would be written in the Sunday supplements. Oh, what a great joke I was playing on the world.
We came from a star before the red men. from the start?
Yes, yes.
The next week, I brought all the Volplas out to the Oakwood. There were 107 men, women, and children. By the end of the week, they were scattered over 4 square miles of the ranch. They hunted sparrows and cooked them over tiny fires. The little creatures delighted me more and more. For hours, I could watch them play. I could sit all afternoon and watch them at work in a treehouse, quite forgetting to go home.
Well, how does the mighty hunter who now returns from the forest?
Fine. Oh, I've been enjoying the local animal life.
So is our daughter.
What do you mean?
She has 2 of them up in her room.
2 what?
I don't know. What do you call them?
I went up the stairs 3 at a time and burst into my daughter's room. There she sat in her bed, reading a book to 2 Volplas.
Hello there, King Arthur.
What's going on here?
Oh, nothing, Daddy. We're just reading like we always do.
Like always? How long has this been going on?
Oh, weeks and weeks. How long is it since that first time you came here to visit me?
Weeks and weeks.
But you're teaching them to read.
Oh, of course. They're such good pupils and so grateful. Daddy, you won't make them go away, will you?
Oh, Jane, why didn't you tell me such a thing like this was going on?
Now, you listen to me, mister. Your whole life is a secret from us. Just what makes you think your daughter can't have a little secret of her own?
Oh, fine secret. Didn't it occur to you that this might be dangerous? Those creatures are...
Oh, Max, for heaven's sakes, they're sweet, lovable little creatures without a harm in their furry little bodies. Now, don't get excited.
Chief! Chief! Look, where are you?
Here, Bush!
Listen. Listen, do you realize there are 2 Volplas in my daughter's bedroom?
Yes, they go there every day. Is there anything wrong with that?
But she's teaching them the words men put on paper.
Yes, you told us men may be enemies. We wish to learn so we can protect. I have thing here.
Well, that's the San Francisco Chronicle.
We've been taking it for some time from box at your house.
Oh.
I have learned from the others. I can read most of this.
It was terrible. The whole wonderful joke of the Volplas would be lost. But I knew what I would have to do. I'd have to explain that my family and I had found a colony of them in our ranch and taught them English and taught them to read. I was stuck with that.
Men are dangerous. They will shoot us with guns if we leave here.
No. Now listen. When they know who you are, they'll leave you alone. Now, you must disperse all your families at once. Send them far away and spread out.
No, we cannot leave these woods. Men would shoot us.
But I'm telling you...
Perhaps you are not a good friend. Perhaps you have lied to us. Why are you saying we should leave these woods?
But it's important. The whole... I mean, you'll be safer.
We will decide.
The whole thing was critical. It could be disastrous. I went back to the house and up to Susie's room. I found her talking to 2 Volplas.
Oh, no. I'm sure you didn't come from the stars. That doesn't sound right. The more I think about it, the more I'm sure that my father made you.
Susie, what business have you telling them that? I don't want you talking to them that way, do you hear me?
Daddy, you want to play a joke, don't you? Like the time you said I could have a horse for my birthday. You gave me that dried seahorse in the bottle instead of a real one. Were you going to make that kind of a joke?
No, Susie, honey, that isn't exactly it, no.
I don't think it's very funny. The Volplas are my friends. I wouldn't want to play a practical joke on them.
Chief! Chief, where are you? Chief!
Oh, confound it. The fires are out. None of them are around. Chief! Are you up there in that treehouse? Where are you? Where are all of you? You've got to listen to me. I made you. The joke, the whole joke is spoiled. Where are you? Chief! Volplas! Volplas! I was away from the house for hours. When I came back, I found Jane sitting on the terrace.
Are you looking for something, dear?
Oh, never mind.
I suppose they're all gone.
What do you mean?
The little flying things. I saw them fly by about 4 in the afternoon.
You did? Where did they go?
Over that way.
You could see them soaring over the trees. Oh, it was so pretty.
Where's Susie?
She's been watching television. She's all excited about the rocket flight, you know.
What rocket?
Oh, you have been living in the woods. The Venus rocket. My goodness, it's been in all the newspapers. Where are you going? Well,
I've got to talk to Susie. Susie! Susie!
Shh, Daddy, the rocket's almost ready to go. Listen!
It approaches 0 hour now. The rocket stands tall and silvery. The gantry crane is pulled away now. We're actually at least 5 miles away, watching from the remote monitors. Some disturbance now. It seems to be some birds. Pig birds, like a flock of owls, circling the ship.
Oh, Daddy, look!
Hey, wait a minute. They're flying through the hatch. It seems to be jammed open. This is certainly an unforeseen development. The men on the ground are driving a motor-driven ladder up to the ship, and the owls seem to be fighting them off. Oh, there goes the hatch. It's closed. Those birds are inside, and they're big birds, big as eagles. As we told you previously, ladies and gentlemen, the rocket is on automatic fire. It'll go off in precisely 10 seconds.
We stared at the television screen. We saw the red blast of fire and the silvery rocket streak up into the sky, the cameras following.
Our reporter at scientific headquarters reports that none of the rocket telemeters are recording. The owls who fluttered into the open hatch in this heartbreaking accident seem to have disrupted the automatic recorders. The control circuit cannot be altered. The rocket will land on Venus as scheduled.
Daddy, those weren't owls, were they?
No. No, they weren't.
Owls. He thought they were owls. That's kind of a joke, isn't it? Isn't it a joke, Daddy?
I'd say, Max, dear, the joke's on you. Wait till men land on Venus and find Venusians with a legend about their great father in California.
Of course, they left me a note. The handwriting wasn't very good, but then you wouldn't write very well either if your index finger was 9 inches long. I sat on the patio and read the Volpla's farewell. It said, "The man who made us, we forgive you. We know we did not come from the stars, but we go there. I, the chief, give you welcome to visit. We will try not to laugh at you. Goodbye."
Fred Collins speaking.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was an NBC Radio Network production.
Now, from the makers of Coldwater Omo,
firing party!
No, 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 please! Please, I...
Firing party!
I can explain
it! Okay.
No, no!
Fire!
John Steed and Jimmy Merlin, handcuffed together, were in the street outside. They heard the shots from the deserted garage and ran towards it. When they arrived, the doors of the garage were wide open. On the floor lay the body of John Cartney.
Well, he won't be able to tell us what it's all about, Merlin.
Steve, look, tied round his neck, a chunk of cardboard.
Yes, and on it written one word, looter.
The Avengers. John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers. We'll be right back.
episode 3 of this story, in which John Steed tenaciously clings to treacherous Jimmy Merlin and tries to find out just what is going on the morning after. The effects of the sleeping gas wore off as the morning wore on. But John Steed still couldn't make sense of what was happening in the market town of St. Catharines. He'd found the whole place quite deserted, apart from the sounds of marching feet and one elusive radio van. In fact, the first person he and Jimmy Merlin saw that day was a dead man.
Shot. Looting. Doesn't make sense.
Nothing does this morning. Mind you, I was sorely tempted back there in the bank.
Is that the reason you tried to jump me and get away, Merlin? The sight of that open safe?
Not really, Steed. I play for far bigger stakes than could be held in a town bank.
You're not going to be playing for any kind of stakes in future. You're going inside a well-guarded jail if it's the last thing I do.
Careful, old boy. It could turn up that way.
Don't try anything.
I wish I could think of something to try. But back to the subject in hand. What about him, the dead man?
Well, let's examine the body.
Why is it so important to find out who he is?
You'll never know.
Want to send flowers to his widow or something?
Just shut up and cooperate for once. Come on, let's go through his pockets.
Steed and Merlin knelt by the body and carefully searched its clothing. Steed found a wallet.
This says Harold Thomas Cartney, 4 Lymington Crescent, Ipswich. Cartney. Harold Cartney. Now that seems to ring a bell.
The only bell it rings to me is an alarm bell. Look, Steed. Neither of us knows what's going on in this desolate place, but we do know that people are shooting each other.
One person has been shot.
So far. But when people start shooting at each other, that's when Mrs. Merlin's youngest son, Jimmy, starts getting out.
All in good time. I want to find out why it's all going on.
Does it matter why?
I think it matters very much indeed. Well, nothing more to be found out from Mr. Harold Thomas Cartney. Come on, let's go.
Now that's better. Back to your car. Turn it round and head on back to London. If there's no one there, I'll know I've gone mad.
Not back to London.
Steve, you obviously like dicing with death more than I do. Now, let's be sensible. Either we make a complete break and get back and away from all this, or we sit tight in this garage until the whole wretched business sorts itself out.
We are not running away.
Well, then let's stay here. It'll be safer to sit tight here and...
I agree. It would be infinitely safer.
Well, then.
But we are leaving right now.
But why? Where to, Steve?
Emma Peel. Do you remember Mrs. Peel? You said that you particularly admired my choice of partner. Now, the lovely creature you turned your oily charms upon before you busted that capsule that knocked us all out?
Ah, yes. Mrs. Peel. Presumably, she's still sleeping it off.
Presumably. But when she wakes, she's going to be alone and very, very vulnerable. So, no more talk. Come on.
Steed dragged the protesting Merlin from the garage and into the silent streets. While this was going on, a small squad of soldiers marched down a street on the other side of the town. At the head of them was Sergeant Hearn, the man in charge of the firing squad. He halted his men outside a large, imposing building.
Halt!
Sergeant Hearn made his way through a yard of parked army trucks, passing a plaque that read Eastern Hemisphere Trade Commission, and pushing open a door that bore the symbol of the skull and crossbones and a warning of radioactivity. He made his way down to a deep cellar. The normally dim, dank steps were illuminated by brilliant lights. A collection of about half a dozen army officers and warrant officers, all wearing protective clothing, gathered round a focal point at the far end of the cellar. They were working on a gleaming mass of scientific apparatus.
Let me see those equations.
Yes, sir.
The brigadier, standing in a position of prominence befitting his authority, studied the clipboard that was handed to him. Major Parsons, standing stiffly at his side, noticed Hearn descending the steps. He moved over to him.
Well, Sergeant?
All quiet on top, sir.
Good, good. Any problems?
One, sir.
A report.
Was it serious?
What occurred?
Well, don't worry, sir. We dealt with him. No fuss, sir.
What's this? What's wrong?
Sir, Sergeant Hearn, we ran into a spot of bother up top, sir.
Report, Sergeant.
Sir, while carrying out a street surveillance, we ran across an unauthorized person in the area. I arrested him and summarily dealt with him according to my orders, sir. I shot him as a looter.
Who was he?
Sir?
This man you shot. Didn't you get his identity?
Well, no, sir.
Well, then do so!
Yes, sir.
Right away, Sergeant, right away.
Sir.
Nobody stayed on in this area without good reason. I want to know why and who. This applies to everyone found up top. See that that order is carried out, Major. At once.
Some while after that, Steed and Jimmy Merlin were cautiously making their way back to the Poston Trading Company, where they hoped to find Mrs. Peel still sleeping.
Nothing so far.
Yeah, got to be careful.
Hey, you know, Steve, this is darn ridiculous. What are we doing snooping about like a couple of Boy Scouts on tracking practice?
Being prepared isn't a bad motto in these circumstances. I wonder who this can be.
It was Sergeant Hearn on his way back to the garage.
Quick, up the steps into the bank.
Steve and Merlin scuttled up the steps of the bank they had previously visited. Inside, they made their way to the rear door. Too bad. It was locked.
We've got to get out of here.
Too bad. Too late.
Hold it! Stay where you are! Right. Taking advantage of the emergency, eh?
Emergency?
Made a break from somewhere, have you? Right, forward, men. Cover them.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Perhaps if you could just explain what all this is about.
Silence!
Surely at least tell us what's happened and then...
If this man speaks again, shoot him.
Stop!
Orders are that anyone found within the area shall be searched. The Brigadier wants a complete check. Right, now let's see what you've got in your pockets.
Hearn began searching the two men. On Jimmy Merlin, he found nothing. On Steed, two wallets.
John Steed and Harold Cartney. Now, which are you?
John Steed.
Silence. You took this from the dead man back there in the garage, didn't you? Didn't you?
As a matter of fact, old chap, yes. You see, I'm attached
to... Looting. Both of you. What's your name?
Merlin. Now, look here, Sergeant. I've had nothing to do with this. Nothing whatsoever. You see, this man, Steed...
have both been found guilty of looting.
Guilty?
I didn't see a judge.
I am the judge. The sentence is death. It will be carried out immediately.
I say. He means it, Steed. He really means it.
Firing party will take up position.
Yes, sir!
Oh, dear, we can't let this happen, Merlin. Handcuffs can be useful for other things than holding people together, you know.
Right, silence. Right, firing squad.
Now, I think, Steve.
Right.
As one man, Steed and Merlin leapt forward. They dropped their handcuffs over the sergeant's neck, pulling him back in front of them and nearly strangling him in the process.
Right. Drop those rifles.
Tell them, Sergeant. Tell them we mean business.
Tell him, Sergeant.
Do as he says.
Right. Stand clear. Come on, Merlin. Right. The door.
Steed and Merlin moved off to the doors, dragging the sergeant between them. When they reached them, they roughly shoved him back into the bank. He sprawled on the floor as they slammed the doors closed and ran towards the armored car. Steed started her up, and they roared off. A burst of shooting from the troopers followed them.
For pity's sake, let's get out of here. We can make it easily enough. Those men were trying to kill us.
But I don't find that encouraging.
Well, Steve, let me off the hook. Undo these blasted handcuffs and let me take my chance alone.
Wouldn't hear of it, my dear chap.
They're after us. I'm too young to die.
You're over 21.
If I were over 80, I'd feel the same. Steve, where are we going?
We're sneaking back.
Sneaking back? Give me three good reasons why.
One, Mrs. Peel is still there. Two, I want to know what's going on.
I said three reasons.
Third one? A terribly obstinate man, how's that?
It's not good enough.
They were the British Army. The sergeant and their firing squad, they were the British Army. And he mentioned a state of emergency. Houses empty, cars abandoned, martial law, it all fits. Now, I'm not moving out of St. Catharines until I find out what sort of emergency. You got that? Understand?
I only understand one thing. If they don't kill me, you will, with careless driving. I promise, Mother, if I ever get out of this alive, I'm going straight. And that's a promise I've never made before.
Thank you.
Avengers.
Listen every evening, Monday to Friday, to John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers. Brought to you by the makers of Coldwater Omo.
Dimension X. On stage tonight, Dimension X.
Tonight, Dimension X presents The Martian Chronicles, a dramatization of the new novel by one of our most brilliant young science fiction writers, Ray Bradbury. The Martian Chronicles. January in the year 1999. 1 minute it was Ohio winter with doors closed, the panes blind with frost, icicles fringing every roof, children skiing on snowy slopes. And then a long wave of warmth crossed the small town, a flooding sea of hot air.
Bye, Mom, I'm going out.
William McClellan, you come back here. You know you can't go out in winter without a coat. You want to catch your death of cold?
But it isn't cold. It's warm outside. It's rocket summer.
Rocket summer?
You know, like Indian summer.
The rocket lay on the launching field, blowing up pink clouds of fire and heat, cracking the icicles, melting the snow, making summer with every breath of its mighty exhausts. It seared the faces of the watching crowd and drove them back. And then they saw the red fire and heard the big sound as the silver rocket shot up toward Mars and left them behind on an ordinary Monday morning on the ordinary planet Earth. They lived in a house of crystal pillars on the planet Mars by the edge of an empty sea. And every morning you could see Ila eating the golden fruits that grew from the crystal walls, or her husband sitting alone in his room reading from a singing metal book over which he brushed his hand as one might play a harp. Ila and her husband were not old. Once they had liked painting pictures with chemical fire, swimming in the canals when the wine trees filled them with green liquors, and talking into the dawn together. But no more. Marriage sometimes makes people old and familiar while still young. And Ila was not happy now. This morning she sat dreaming between the crystal pillars and wished that somehow a miracle might happen. And then suddenly...
Oh. Ila! Did you fall?
No.
I thought I heard you cry out.
Did I? I was almost asleep and had a dream.
In the daytime? You don't often do that.
Strange. How very strange. I dreamed about a man. A tall man. 6 feet tall.
Oh, how absurd. He'd be a giant, a misshapen giant.
I know. And yet, somehow he looked quite handsome. He was dressed in a strange uniform. And he came down out of the sky in a long silver craft.
Out of the sky? What nonsense.
He spoke pleasantly to me in another language. But somehow I understood him with my mind. Telepathy, I suppose.
Oh, really, Ila?
And he said, I've come from the third planet in my ship. My name is Nathaniel York.
A stupid name. Whoever heard of a name like that?
Perhaps they have names like that on Earth.
That's ridiculous, Ila. Everyone knows the third planet is incapable of supporting life. There's too much oxygen in their atmosphere.
I suppose. But haven't you ever wondered if... Well, wouldn't it be fascinating if there were people there and they traveled through space in some sort of ship?
Really, Ila? You know I hate this emotional wailing. Now let's get on with our work.
Evening came. The twin white moons of Mars were rising, and the house closed itself in like a giant flower. A wind blew among the pillars, stirring Ela's russet hair, crooning softly in her ear. And it was then that she began singing the song.
Drink to me, O me, thine eyes, and I will pledge with mine.
Ela, what's that song?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? I've never heard it before. Did you compose it?
No. Yes. No, I don't know, really. I don't even know what the words are. They're in another language. It was part of a dream I had, I guess.
Oh. You know, you haven't been yourself lately. It might do you good if we went away to the Blue Mountains for a week or so.
What?
Did you hear what I said?
I'm sorry. I was watching the sky.
You're certainly interested in the sky tonight.
It's very beautiful.
Well, what about my suggestion? Shall we leave for the Blue Mountains in the morning?
You mean go away now? Oh, no.
No? Why not? Why don't you want to go?
I don't know. I just don't want to, that's all. Oh, leave a kiss. The cup and not a school.
Ela, I'm sick of that silly song. It's late. Let us sleep. From the crystal walls poured a soft carpeting of mist to support Ela where she lay down to sleep. But through the night she tossed restlessly, until just at dawn the dream recurred. Ela! Ela, wake up!
What? Oh, what is it?
You've been dreaming again. You talked in your sleep.
Did I?
Yes. What were you dreaming?
Oh, the ship. It came from the sky again. And the tall man stepped out and talked with me. Telling me little jokes and laughing.
What else happened?
And then this Captain York... Oh, I can't. It's all so silly.
Tell me!
He said I was beautiful. And then he kissed me.
I thought so. What else?
Why, Eel, you're so bad-tempered. It's only a dream.
Is it? You know I can read your mind. You can't keep secrets from me.
Well, all that happened was this Captain York told me... Well, he told me he'd take me away in his ship, into the sky. Take me back to his planet with him. It's quite ridiculous, really.
Ridiculous, is it? You should have heard yourself. Fawning on him, talking to him, singing with him all night. In your dream, he landed in Green Valley, didn't he?
Please.
And he told you he was coming today.
Yes. But what's come over you? It's only a dream. You can't be jealous of that.
No, no, I suppose not. Forgive me. I'm being childish.
Eel, you're sick. You've been working too hard.
No, no, I'm all right. But perhaps you're right. Maybe I could use a little relaxation.
Yes.
I think I'll take the morning off and go hunting.
Hunting?
Yes, in Green Valley. Numbly, she watched him go to a closet and draw forth an evil-looking weapon. And then her husband was gone, walking toward Green Valley. And Ela waited, watching the sky for an unknown thing, trembling with a nameless fear. And then it happened. A whirring, rushing sound. The warmth as of a giant fire passing in the air. The gleam of metal in the sky.
He's come. It's true. The dream is true.
The rocket vanished over the hill. The sky was empty again. And trembling, Ela waited again, looking toward Green Valley and seeing nothing. Listening for sounds and hearing nothing. Until... A shot sounded. Very sharply, the sound of the evil weapon.
Oh, no. No, no, no.
Her body jerked with the sound. And she wanted to scream and never stop screaming. For now she knew the dream could never come true. There was nothing left but the song, the strange and fine and beautiful song.
Drink to me only with thine eyes, and I will pledge with mine. Or leave a kiss within the cup.
But still the rockets came. The next ship came down from the stars and the black velocities and the silent gulfs of space and landed by night near a Martian city. The men made their way to the outer rim of the dreaming city, and then Jeff Spender went in to reconnoiter while the others watched and waited. Waited for something to stir in the haunted city, some gray form to rise, some voice to break the unearthly stillness. Where were the people? Where were the Martians? Nothing stirred to disturb the silence until...
Halt! Who goes there?
Don't shoot!
Hold it, Parker. Let Spender and his party. They're coming back.
Captain Wells!
Over here.
Well?
Captain, we've searched the city. People were living here last week.
People?
Martians.
Where are they now?
Dead.
Dead? What did they die of?
You won't believe it, Captain. Chickenpox.
Good Lord, no.
Yes. No resistance to an Earth disease, I guess.
So the other rocket did get through to Mars.
It looks like it, Captain. God only knows what the Martians did to them. But at least we know what they did to the Martians.
You mean they're all dead?
Yes. This planet is through.
Hey! You hear that, guys? We're safe! Break out a bottle, Cookie. Let's have a drink to celebrate.
Stop it, Parkhill. Put down that bottle!
What's eating you, Spender? The planet's ours now. We got a christener, don't we? I christen thee the city of... Hey, Park Hill City, huh?
Park Hill, I warned you!
All right, Spender, that's enough. That'll cost you a $50 fine. Cookie, McClure, take care of Park Hill. Spender, you come with me. All right, Spender. Why did you hit him?
I don't know, Captain. I was ashamed, I guess. Ashamed of Sam Parkhill and the noise and the spectacle the whole crew is making.
It's been a long trip. It's only natural they'd want to have their fling.
Yes, but where's their sense of what's right? Their respect for what's happened here? Captain, a race builds itself for a million years, refines itself, builds cities like this one, does everything it can to give itself respect and beauty and... And then it dies. Of what? Not anything fine or majestic or fitting, but a dirty little thing like chickenpox. And Sam Parkhill wants to celebrate.
I know, Spender, but you've got to remember you've a different way of seeing things.
I'm seeing things all right. I'm seeing what we'll do to Mars. We'll rip it up, rip the skin off, ruin it the way we've ruined our own planet. Captain, look at the city. It may be the last time you'll ever see it this way.
Beautiful in the moonlight, isn't it?
Yes. There's a poem by Byron that describes it and how the Martians would feel tonight if there were any of them left. So we'll go no more a-roving so late into the night. Though the heart be still as loving and the moon be still as bright. For the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul wears out the breast. And the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself must rest. Though the night was made for loving and the day returns too soon. Yet we'll go no more a-roving by the light of the moon.
Without a word, the Earthmen stood and looked at the city. A bottle lay shattered at Sam Parkhill's feet, and the sour stench of liquor filled the cool air. The men of Earth had come to Mars. The men of Earth came to Mars. They came because they were afraid or unafraid, because they were happy or unhappy, because they felt like pilgrims or did not feel like pilgrims. The government posters screamed, "There's work for you in the sky. See more." The men shuffled forward, all kinds of men, all coming for different reasons. The rockets came like drums beating in the night. They came like locusts, swarming and settling in blooms of rosy smoke. Mars was a distant shore, and the settlers spread upon it in waves. First the pioneers and builders, then the people of civilization. Some came because they were afraid of a coming war on Earth. Some came because they were afraid of nothing. Some came to escape from the smell of the subways and the cabbage tenements. And some came from houses like the one in Ohio. It was a good house, the house in Ohio. And for 6 years, the family had lived there contentedly, enjoying music and poetry and the rich, warm things of life. For the house had been built to be lived in the year 2020. It contained all the latest automatic devices, from talking book recorders to singing clocks. As the family rose and dressed, the beds whirred electronically and made themselves. In the kitchen, the stove sighed and ejected from its warm interior 8 eggs, sunny side up, 12 bacon slices, 2 coffees, and 2 glasses of milk.
7-9, breakfast time. Come and dine. 7-9.
Beside the breakfast table, the facsimile machine clacked and deposited the morning paper on the table. The headlines today spoke ominously of the danger of a coming war, and the man frowned as he read the news.
Today is August 4th, 2026. Insurance, gas, and atom heat bills are due, and today, remember, the family has planned a picnic.
Gee, Dad, are we really going?
Sure, Timmy, why not?
It's raining out.
It's not raining where we're going, son. Now run upstairs, pack your fishing tackle. We're going on our picnic, all right.
Okay, Dad.
Bill, are you sure we ought to go?
Yes. Have you seen the headlines this morning?
Looks bad, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. The rocket's ready. All we have to do is pack and take off.
I know, but... well, flying to Mars, it seems so crazy. Well, all right, then we'll go. Should we tell the children why we're going?
No, not yet. Let them enjoy the picnic.
The house went on with its appointed tasks.
9:15, time to clean. 9:15, time to clean.
Out of the molding darted hundreds of tiny mechanical mice, all rubber and metal. They sucked up the dust and dirt in the house and popped back into their burrows. In the walls, relays clicked, memory tapes glided under electric eyes, recorded voices moved under steel needles.
12 o'clock, 2 o'clock. 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock, tick-tock, 8 o'clock.
Evening came. In the living room, the hearth fire bloomed out of nothing, and the phonograph spoke from beside the fireplace.
Mrs. McLellan, what poem would you like to hear this evening? Mr. McLellan, since you express no preference, I shall select at random from among your favorites. Sarah Teasdale, There Will Come Soft Rains.
There will come soft rains and the smell of the ground, and swallows circling with their shimmering sound, and frogs in the pool singing at night, and wild plum trees in tremulous white. Robins will wear their feathery fire, whistling their whims on a low fence wire, and not one will know of war, not one will care at last when it is done. Not one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly. And spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone.
The phonograph finished the poem, but there was no one there to hear, for the family had gone to Mars.
Fire! Fire!
On the Martian desert beside the highway, there rose a blare of red and yellow neon lights that spelled the death of Jeff Spender's dream. Sam's hot dog stand is what the sign read. And Sam, of course, was the same Sam Parkhill who had fought with Spender years before. 10,000 rockets were reported leaving soon for Mars, with 100,000 hungry customers. And Sam wanted to be ready for them.
Hey, look up there, Elmer.
Mm-hmm.
See that green star up there? That's Earth. Good old wonderful Earth. Makes you feel almost reverent, don't it?
Yeah.
Sam, you're hungry and you're starved. Something. That's a poem I learned in school. Come on, Earth, send me your rockets. Here's Sam Parker with the only hot dog stand on Mars.
Sam, what if the rockets don't come? What if there's a war on Earth?
Don't worry, they're coming all right. Ain't nothing gonna happen to spoil my plans, baby. I figured it all out.
Sam! Hey, Sam, look up there! Earth!
Well, what? Oh, no.
It's catching fire. It's burning.
Oh, no, that can't be Earth. Elmer, they can't do this to me. I got all our money invested in this place.
Go ahead, Sam. Switch on more lights. Turn up the music. Get the hot dogs on the fire. There'll be another batch of customers coming along in about 100 million years.
Oh, no, it couldn't be.
What a swell spot for a hot dog stand. Let you in on a little secret, Sam. This looks like it's going to be an off-season.
The light beam radio crackled with the news. By morning, the shelves of the luggage store were empty, and the rockets were blasting off, headed back to Earth. In a few days, everyone was gone, and the planet of Mars once more lay deserted and silent. And then, after all the rest had gone, one last rocket landed on Mars. A small, family-sized rocket come all the way from Earth. It seemed a long way to go for a picnic, but Dad had suggested a fishing trip, and Mother thought the whole family would enjoy a vacation. So here they were, floating down a Martian canal, with Timothy sitting in the back of the boat with Dad and Mother up front holding Alice the baby, and the deserted Martian towns drifting slowly by.
Dad!
What is it, Timmy?
When do we see the Martians? You promised we would.
Soon, Tim, soon.
Oh, but William, the last Martians died out years ago. They're a dead race now.
Not quite. Don't worry, son. I'll show you some real live Martians later on.
Gee, this is swell. I wish we didn't ever have to go home. How long can we stay?
1 million years.
1 million years?
Yes. It's time we told you, son, we're not going home. This is where we'll live from now on.
But what about the rocket? What about Ohio?
There's nothing there now but ruins. The last Earth radio just went off the air. That means the war is over and Earth is finished. We're going to blow up our rocket and start all over. See if we can't build a better world up here.
You mean Mars is going to be our home?
Yes. I hope you don't mind too much.
No, sir. But what about the Martians? When do we get to see them?
There they are, son. Look down at the water.
I don't see anything there.
Beside the boat. Look at the reflections in the water.
But that's us down there. Just you and me and Mom and the baby.
Yes, son. You see, we're the Martians now.
For a long, silent moment, Timmy stared down at the reflections of the family in the waters. And the Martian stared back up at him. Then he lifted his eyes to the deep ocean sky, trying once more to see Earth and the house he had always called home. But Earth was too far away, and the house was now only a heap of radioactive rubble. Only one wall remained standing, and within the wall a voice spoke again and again. And again.
Not one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly, and spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone, that we were gone, that we were gone, that we were gone, that we were gone.
2026. Today is October 5th, 2026.
You have just heard The Martian Chronicles, a dramatization of highlights from the new novel by Ray Bradbury.
The world of
Dimension X.
Have a good evening and come back again next week. This has been Bill Holwick from West Texas for Broken Sea Audio Productions. www.brokensea.com. Good evening. Good evening. The music for tonight's episode was composed by Brian of Seraphic Panoply and Stevie Farnaby.